Hello and welcome to the Really Cool People podcast. I'm your host, Jason Leininger, and this is a podcast produced by Schweitzer Church. This is a place to hear stories of really cool people that I've met and find these stories fascinating and amazing. The hope is that as we listen along, we'll be inspired, encouraged, and challenged through moments of serendipity. C.S. Lewis once said that there are no ordinary people. You and I have never talked to a mere mortal. And it is true. Every time I sit down and hear stories of people, I find that there's something fascinating, something deeply interesting. And so, even though many of us think that we're just ordinary people, the truth is that you and I, the people we talk with and meet in these podcasts, are really cool people. So today, we're going to meet Mindy Miller. Mindy is going to talk about a charmed childhood. And then she's going to share with us about becoming a mom of four kids. And the last kid, Kelly, is going to take up the balance of her story because Kelly has left a special mark. So let's lean in and hear Mindy's story. Friends, we are happy to welcome Mindy Miller to the Really Cool People podcast. So Mindy, let's start with your story.
I was born into a family where my dad was finishing up his residency, his surgical residency in Kansas City. And Melissa was 18 months old when I was born. And we moved to Springfield where he joined a practice here about the time I was about 18 months old. And my poor mother, as we think about this, she was pregnant. It was the summer. She had two little girls, and her husband was gone all the time. I don't know how she did it because, you know, they didn't have air conditioning or anything. But, Melissa was three. I was 18 months, and then she had our brother. And then she had one more 2 years after that. So there was four of us all together, three girls and a boy. We had a wonderful childhood. You know, just, we grew up in the late 50s, the 60s, as elementary kids. We moved from our initial place. We moved to a house over, it was in the Holland School District where Melissa and I started school. And we used to walk to school, you know. Our mother would walk with us sometimes, but sometimes we wouldn't, you know, walk down. Whatever was that, Seminole, I guess, to Holland School. Even in the snow, I remember following my mom to and from because we would come home for lunch. That was a thing back then. You could actually walk home for lunch. And we would walk home, and I remember following in her footsteps in the snow, you know, because school, of course, didn't get called off because of snow very often. But we moved from there when I was in the middle of second grade, and we moved over to this side of town. We lived by one of the lakes in Southern Hills, lived in an old farmhouse. My mother always said it was like the original farmhouse built in 1910, and that was an awesome home to grow up in. Had all kinds of nooks and crannies, had a basement and an attic, and we used to have so much fun playing hide and seek and all that with our friends. We had lots of neighborhood friends. In fourth grade, actually this summer before fourth grade, they built Wilder School. And we used to go up in the summer and actually help the men laying the tile in our classrooms. They would actually let us help them lay tile. I remember that so vividly. And then when we started school that fall, it was really exciting because we would say, look, I laid that tile, you know, the things that a fourth grader gets excited about. But anyway, we had a lot of fun as kids. We climbed trees. We played in all the vacant lots that were in Southern Hills at the time, which I don't think there are any now, but in fact, when I said something to my kids about, we used to play in vacant lots, they're like, what are vacant lots? Because they weren't used to that. But we would play, you know, stickball and baseball and football and broom hockey. And we had a great, great time with all the neighbors. And we would be out till it got dark, and my mom had a bell. She would ring a bell, and everybody'd say, Mosley's have to go home. So anyway, it was really fun. And I had a bike that I loved, and I would used to get up in the morning, get on my bike, and go ride. You know, nobody knew where I was, but nobody was worried. What a lovely time. But anyway, I went to Glendale, and that was fun, too. Got involved in a lot of different activities there. Ended up going to the University of Missouri, and my older sister had gone to Arkansas, so I had to do the opposite and go to Missouri. When you're 18 months apart, you have to distinguish yourself in some way. So she would do one thing and I would do the other. Right now, we do everything alike. So, but anyway, so I went to the University of Missouri and really enjoyed my time there. Steve and I started going out after our sophomore year. We had had classes together at Glendale, but he wasn't much interested in me at the time. But that summer, his mother pointed out that I was obviously not doing anything because I was with my parents at a softball game where he was with his parents. So we started dating, and it was one of those things where when he called me, I immediately had this feeling like, okay, this is it. I'm not going to be dating anyone else anymore. Isn't that weird? But it was really very, I remember hanging up the phone and thinking, wow, that was crazy. But anyway, so yeah, we got married when we graduated. He was a student at Rolla at the University of Missouri. It was called the University of Missouri at Rolla. It's now Missouri S&T. And we got married when we graduated and went to Marshalltown, Iowa, where he took a job with a company up there called Fisher Controls. And it was a division of Monsanto. And we lived up there it was really only like a year and a half because my youngest sister, Mary, who you've never met, was in a really bad car accident after her freshman year in college, which she was 4 years younger than I was. So it was like almost to the day on our year anniversary that she was in a bad car accident. Had a brain injury, a brain stem injury, and I spent a lot of time coming home, just to help my parents because she had to really start over almost, like learning to do things. And there's all kinds of, brain injuries are crazy. And anyway, she's fine today. to make a long story short, she is fine today, and she's married and lives in Chillicothe. But at the time, we didn't know. I mean, she was in the ICU for quite a while, and then when they brought her out of there, she still wasn't responding real well. But it was just a matter of getting all of her signals going through that brainstem correctly again. And that was really a long, drawn-out process. And my dad was a surgeon. So his line of work, and it's kind of silly to say it, but it was cut and dry. You know, if something's wrong, you fix it. You know, you cut it out and you sew it up. And there, he says, and then God does all the healing. But with a neurology thing, it's truly gray matter. It's not black and white. My dad's world was black and white. So he was very frustrated with brain injury, with the whole idea of a brain injury. It went against everything he knew. He couldn't do anything. He felt helpless. And we all did. But it was a real turning point for Steve and me. We were like, why are we up here? You know, what are we doing up here when our families are down there? And Steve's dad had a steel foundry here. And he says, I have a spot for you if you'd like to come down and work. Steve had, I don't know what they do. Is it a minor in metallurgy or whatever? he did exactly what his dad had done in school. And anyway, so he came home. We both came home and ended up getting a house. And I had Lindsay, my oldest, within a year or so after we got home. And stayed home with my kids. I had Lindsay, and then 2.5, almost 3 years later, we had Jenny, our second one, who goes to church here, Jenny Talbert. And then we waited 6 years. We decided we needed another child, and we had our son, John. And then I was so excited. I thought, I'm not going to have any more kids. Our little family's all put together. And lo and behold, God said, aha, I've got a present for you. And it was funny because I look back and I think, I remember distinctly saying, and I feel guilty for saying this now because I know there's so many women who have trouble having children or can't have children. But I thought I was through with my family, and I wasn't. And little did I know how unfinished I was. But I remember saying things like, oh, I don't think I can stand up, potty train another kid, or teach somebody the alphabet again. I just don't think I can do it. And I haven't had to. Because, you know, Kelly doesn't do those things. So, and I think about that. I think, oh, gosh, that was a crazy thing to say. But it was very foresighted, too, you know, in a way. But anyway, so Kelly came along as a surprise. People have said, oh, she's your bonus and she's your forever baby. And she is. You know, I was ready to move on and do something with my life. You know, when my kids were, my two older ones were in school when John was born. And he was 3 when Kelly was born. So, and we honestly, when she was born, we thought she was perfect. Her Apgar scores, you know, that they give newborns were great. They were 9s and 10s. And, I was in a shared room at the time when I gave birth. You know, that was back when they didn't have those the luxury suites that you have now. But my roommate, and I didn't see her for a long time because there was a curtain between us. And they brought her in, and she had just given birth. And they discovered that her child had Down syndrome. And I remember feeling so bad for her. And I had Kelly with me, and I kept trying to keep her from crying because this woman was very distraught, obviously, and all of her friends and family were coming in, and they were trying to get her moved to a private room because that would only be helpful to her. She didn't want to be with me and my healthy baby. And anyway, I so remember that. And she moved out really before I even got to know her. But I could hear a conversation, and I picked up on a few things about her. And ironically, of course, when Kelly started, and I started taking Kelly to the parent-child class at the Developmental Center of the Ozarks, they used to have a class where you could bring your infant or your toddler or whoever that had some kind of a disability, and they would work with you, and plus you'd get to know other parents. And they had all the kids' names and their birth dates on the wall, and I looked at the wall, and there was December 4th, 1991, and I thought, and the little girl's name. And I thought, oh my gosh. And I found out which one she was, and I asked the mother, I said, you know, our daughters have the same birthday. And we started talking and realized she was the one in the room with me. It was just the craziest thing. And we're still, you know, we still stay in contact to this day. But she and I have not laughed, but we have just talked about how crazy it is that here I was sitting over there praying, and my girls, They were, what, 6 and 9? No, they were 9 and 12 when Kelly was born. Old enough to pray, you know. And we prayed for that mother and that little girl because we felt so bad for them. And here we had this perfect baby, you know. And it turns out that that little girl is accomplishing things. You know, she does a lot of stuff that Kelly can't do. And her mother and I have said, wow, you know. And she said, oh, I did not like you. She said, I was so resentful that you were over there and your baby was crying. And, you know, I could hear you. And she said, I just felt like it was so cruel. And I understood that's how she felt. But it was so ironic that we would run into each other later on in life. And, well, actually, it was only a few years, but we are still friends. And, you know, it's been fun watching her path and my path and understanding where we started out. It's kind of a crazy story. But Kelly has, you know, she upended all of my plans, of course, my plans to go out and I don't even know what I would have done, but accomplish and do. And my other three kids were amazing. You know, they all did really well in school, and each one had their own specialty, whether it be academics or athletics or music or whatever, performing. And they paid most of their way through college, through their activities and stuff. But having Kelly as their sister changed them in a enormous way, changed our whole family. I've always said that if there was anything that was going to get me on my knees on a daily basis, it would be a child like Kelly. After I had her, I realized that was the bonus of having her, is that I found out that I wasn't as smart or as independent or as accomplished or anything that I thought, that I was very, very dependent on my Father in heaven to hold my hand in. And it's been so amazing seeing the times that he has stepped in and said, don't worry, I got this. One of my favorite stories happened. Kelly went undiagnosed for 6 years. They couldn't figure out. Well, let me back up. When she was a baby, we thought she was great. And then, you know, when babies start doing things, well, she maybe wasn't doing things as quickly as other babies. But everybody'd say, oh, she's your fourth. You carry her around all the time. And I did. I mean, she went to every ball practice and every, you know, music lesson and all that. She was just always, I was always toting her around somewhere. And, but, you know, it got to be 6 months and she wasn't rolling over. And that's pushing it a little bit, you know. Or she wasn't sitting, or she was just a great little baby, you know. She just wasn't doing what she was supposed to be doing. And interestingly enough, our pediatrician, he did suggest testing her, and we started testing her along about, well, when her developmental lag got to be several months, I mean, more than could be accounted for by just being the fourth child and being toted around all the time. It was along about her first birthday. We started doing all these tests, and everything was negative. You know, we had her chromosomes tested. We had everything tested. And they couldn't come up with a diagnosis for her. But all she could do was lie on the floor. You know, she was just lying there. And my pediatrician, you know, I talked to him. I'm like, isn't there something we could be doing? And he said, and I know he didn't mean it to sound the way it did, but he said, all she needs is good parenting skills. And I'm like, I got three that have turned out pretty well, you know, so far. I didn't say that, but I was thinking to myself, good parenting skills? What am I missing here? And talking to his nurse, she says, you know, he doesn't believe in any kind of therapies. And I'm like, oh. So I luckily found a wonderful pediatrician, member of Schweitzer, who was glad to take me and my daughter and my other three kids on, because I just had to. Pediatrician number one had been great for my normal kids, but for Kelly, who, you know, was at the other end of the curve, it just didn't work. I said, I can't stand to watch her lying on the ground one more day. We've got to be doing something. And, you know, we didn't have internet like we do now. I couldn't Google stuff. And I couldn't say what to do with your child who isn't rolling over or whatever. So anyway, we did start in at the Developmental Center of the Ozarks and started getting some, you know, occupational therapy and physical therapy and all that. And then, and she actually stayed there until she was ready for kindergarten age. And it was crazy because the summer before she went into kindergarten, she one of her occupational therapists said, do you still not have a diagnosis on her? And I said, no. She's still called developmentally delayed, which was kind of a cruel diagnosis because delay sounds like it's coming, and I wasn't seeing it coming, you know. So she said, well, I know someone who knows someone who says they know someone who's like, who Kelly reminds him of. So she gave me this a piece of paper she printed out on Angelman syndrome. So I went home. By that time, we did have the internet, but it was dial-up internet. So I dialed up, used my family's allotted minutes for the month, you know, looking up Angelman syndrome and printing off stuff on my tractor feed printer. And I went through and I could checkmark all of the, you know, here's the characteristics in all kids who have Angelman syndrome. Check, check, check. That's all I could see. And so I took all of that to Dr. McNeil, and he's like, you know, I don't know, because she doesn't seem to, the main characteristic is a very happy, smiling demeanor, and she doesn't seem to be that way. And I said, well, it's because you're a doctor. And she's got white coat syndrome, because she did. She'd been poked and prodded for most of her years. And she would cry when I'd take her to the doctor. So he agreed, and bless him. He was is such a blessing to my family. But he got her chromosomes tested again, because there had been a new test come up since we had had it done when she was a year old. And she has a deletion on the 15th maternal chromosome. So it wasn't something that I did when I was pregnant, which I actually had an insurance lady ask me that on the phone one time. What did you do when you were pregnant that made her be like this? I'm like, I hope nothing. You know, that was, I know she meant well, but it was kind of a cruel thing to say. But anyway, so, but anyway, when she went to school her first day of kindergarten, I came home and got the phone call from the University of Missouri genetics lab that, yes, she was positive for Angelman syndrome. And then I found out why I was married to Steve, because I called Steve up devastated, because I'd seen all the pictures, you know, and this horrible underbite and all of this mental retardation and all this stuff that I didn't want to think about. And he's like, well, that is great news. And I'm like, what? That is not great news. He goes, no, now you know, we know what she has, and now we'll have a direction to go, and now you know it's not something you did when you were pregnant, you know? I mean, and I said, thank you, God, for giving me this man, because this is what I need, is someone who will turn my brain the right direction. But anyway, anyway, it's been a journey. And it still continues to this day. One of my favorite stories, as I started to tell it, but I had to give you the background, was Jenny went with me to my first Angelman Syndrome conference. It was in Philadelphia. Kelly was 7 or 8. And I didn't want to go by myself. It was a long way to go and a whole lot of information to try to swallow, you know, drinking from the fire hose is what it would have been like. So she said she'd be glad to go. And so she went with me. And I'd never seen someone else with Angelman syndrome. And we're in the airport and there's a little girl sitting in a wheelchair with a smile on her face that looked just like Kelly. And I'm like, oh my gosh, look at that girl. And we're like, we were trying to figure out a way to get to the hotel because it was kind of a peculiar airport and the cabs weren't obvious. So I went up to the father and I said, are you going to the Angelman syndrome conference? And he said, well, yes. Thought, of course you are, because she obviously has the same thing my daughter does. So we rode with them, and it was so crazy all week. I mean, you could hear these laughter and all this that sounded just like my daughter everywhere. But we learned so many things. And at one video presentation, they were showing something about seizures. And Kelly had seen a neurologist and had an EEG, but she wasn't taking any medicine for seizures because the doctor didn't feel like what he saw would be helped or was alarming enough. If we weren't seeing seizures, you know, and we didn't think we were seeing seizures, but I mean, we weren't seeing the big ones that we've seen on TV or whatever. So watching this video, Jenny and I look at each other and go, oh my gosh, that's what Kelly does all the time. You know, just the movements and the erratic whatever behavior, because the kid was getting an EEG and then you could see the printout and they were pointing out, now he's having a seizure and now he's having a seizure. So I thought, oh gosh, I've got to go tell this doctor that he was wrong. And I was a doctor's daughter and my dad was never wrong, you know. And I'd heard him plenty of times say, they came in and tried to tell me, you know, and I was right and they were wrong. And I mean, you want a surgeon that's confident. And he was very confident. So I have this ingrained inability to criticize doctors or to suggest something, you know. So I was really stressed about this and thinking, how am I going to do this? Because he was this very vaunted neurosurgeon and not neurosurgeon, neurologist. And anyway, so I didn't know what to do. But anyway, we got on the plane to come home. It's crowded, you know, and we stop in St. Louis. And it was some kind of a prop plane or something where the noise was right outside our window. And Jenny's head was just pounding. And I went up and see if we could change seats. And they said, no, it's full. The plane's full. You can't change seats. So I'm like, oh, great. So I said, I'll switch with you. And we're handing out our little Angelman Syndrome Conference t-shirts. And I had my big notebook with all my stuff. And we get back on the plane in St. Louis. And I'm sitting there. And they announced that, you know, we're going to be delayed. We're going to have to sit and wait for takeoff. And it might be 15, 20 minutes. So people pull out their cell phones and start calling. And I heard this voice. And of course, it was the neurologist sitting across the aisle from us. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's right there. And so I thought, okay, God, you put him right there. You knew I needed him in a casual situation where I wouldn't feel intimidated. So I leaned forward and said something to him. And I held out my shirt. And he's like, oh. And so he switched seats. Sat by me, and I did too. We sat on the aisle, and I was able to tell him what I learned. I gave him the information out of the notebook that I had with me. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, you love Kelly that much, you know? Anyway, that's happened to me so many times where things that I worry about with her, God just smooths the way, you know? Another time, she had her wisdom teeth growing in. We do the dentist, but he can't do anything. You know, he can't do fillings. He can't do x-rays. He just kind of looks at her teeth. And we have to knock her out every 3 years. And we do everything. We do all the x-rays and all the, if she needs any fillings or whatever. And so he kept saying, these wisdom teeth are coming in. We're going to have to do something. And I'm like, how can we pull her wisdom teeth? I mean, it'll be easy for you guys. Horrible that aftercare. You know, keep your tongue out of the empty sockets and keep the gauze in there. I thought, she will swallow the gauze, you know. So Steve and I were very stressed about this, and we prayed for years. I mean, I bet it was 6 years that we talked about these wisdom teeth. And finally, they're like, okay, we've got to get them out. And I said, okay, you know, if you can get them out, fine. I mean, we felt like, okay, the time is right. We're going to do it. And I wish you could have seen the oral surgeon's face when he came out. He was like, that's never happened to me before. He said those roots were tapered just right. All I had to do was pluck them out. You know, usually they're whatever. And he said it closed up underneath. She hardly bled. He said it was an amazing. He said, I don't know what you did. I said, we pray. We've been praying about these teeth. He said, I ought to have you pray about all my other patients. Because it was like, she hardly even had any swelling. It was just a miracle. And once again, I'm like, thank you, God. You did that for her. Because she couldn't, I mean, we would have had to keep her anesthetized for 3 days till her swelling and bleeding and all that stopped. But anyway, we just keep seeing evidences of that. So when, you know, we're now at the stage of life where we're like, we're not going to be here forever to take care of her. But we know she will be cared for, you know. She has siblings, but more than that, she has a father in heaven who loves her very much.
Wow. You said you were going to, it might be a challenge for you to talk for 30 minutes. But
Not if I'm talking about Kelly. Yeah. I knew that's what I have to talk about. Because she's it.
She's it. Yeah. That's an incredible journey. Let's go back for a little bit to your parents. And to the childhood that you had. Uh-huh. And to that almost magical world.
Oh, yeah.
Where, I mean, the picture you painted was almost like a Norman Rockwell or one of those things that you... one of those things that you see in one of those little balls. Yeah. And you pick it up and the snowflakes come down.
Yeah.
And it
looks like that. Well, you know, and it wasn't... There were bad. I mean, looking back, it's great. I mean, compared to what kids go through today,
sure,
and the things they're exposed to, and all that, we just had a great time. You know, it was we played outside all the time. We rode our bikes. We ice skated on the ponds. That was back when they used to freeze. They don't freeze anymore.
Yeah,
but we went sledding. I mean, we just climb trees all the time. I had to teach my grandchildren how to climb trees.
Well, think about that time of your life. What did your parents instill within you as you've journeyed with your own kids and journeyed with Kelly that have been things that you've gone back to, you've relied upon? What were some of the gifts that they gave you? You know, not necessarily physical gifts, but gifts that they ingrained within you?
Well, family was a big thing. Mm-hmm. No. My dad wasn't around a lot. I mean, he worked incredible hours because that was back in the days of private practice and you didn't have any doctors at the hospital. So he always took emergency room duty every weekend and overnight, you know, he'd get calls in the night. He'd have to go out and go to the emergency room. So my mom did a really good job of instilling respect and gratitude and love in us for him, you know, because he was working real, real hard. But as I look back, you know, I'm amazed by my mom, by what she did. Mm. Melissa and I laugh about that, about how, and of course, she was a very traditional lady. I mean, they grew up in the South. She believed in bridge parties and, you know, nut bowls and, you know, the other day, I got this one day, it was on Mother's Day, in fact, and the newspaper gave a one day free subscription to newspapers.com so you could look up your mother. So I spent a lot of time Sunday afternoon looking up articles for my mom and sending them to my siblings, you know. And it was really funny. We're like, how did she have this many parties, you know, because she would host, and we had a great house for hosting parties, but she was in all these different clubs and all that. And she was a very intelligent lady, you know. I don't think that we really realized it at the time, but she kept a lot of plates spinning, you know, in the air. But I feel like family. I mean, my parents gave me three amazing siblings, and for that, I'm very grateful. And we haven't had the squabbles that I think so many families do with their with siblings, you know. I mean, as adults, they're like, oh, I don't even talk to my brother. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I adore my brother. But I credit my mom with that a lot. Because even when she and my dad were failing, she had a series of strokes that really robbed her or took her from us early, you know. Well, I shouldn't say early. She was about my age, I guess. But we all worked together, you know, helping my dad with her. And then when he faced his impending death, you know, we were all able to work together and appreciate each other and the different gifts that we had. And I'm just very grateful to my parents for that. Somehow or another, we get along. I don't know why, but we do. And that's an amazing gift that not everybody has.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic gift.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm at Schweitzer's, because Melissa was here, you know, among other things.
That, yes. One of the things you mentioned along the way, actually, you did it several different times. You recalled things that people have said along the way. Mm-hmm. Like in describing Kelly, you said people would call her your bonus baby or your forever baby.
Mm-hmm.
You had really good recollection about what the pediatrician number one said.
Oh, that
all
yes.
she needs is good parenting.
Yes.
Or the insurance agent, like, what'd you do when you were pregnant? And how old's Kelly?
31.
So these are things that have been said that have you've carried with you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So how does that, what's that do to your heart, and how do you take all that in? And
well, you know, when you hear something or see something and you have an emotional reaction to it, it's ingrained forever. You know, I mean, you learn that just like, I have one daughter who always tells her kids to protect their eyes when TV's on, you know, because if something comes on, she's like, protect your eye, when they were little. Because you don't want them to have that emotional reaction where they can't unsee it and I can't unhear it. Because I did have an emotional reaction to all of that. When someone says, oh, she's just going to be your forever baby, I'm like, that's true. You know, she is my forever baby. I'm still changing her diapers. You know, I'm still fixing her food and feeding her at times because she doesn't do super well with utensils. And you know, we're still, one of your questions was, what gets you up in the morning? Well, Kelly has to be clothed and fed and taken care of every day. You know, you don't just get up and think, ah, got a great day. What am I going to do? Because it's like, first I deal with her, or Steve does. You know, he's retired now, so he's an amazing dad. But, yeah. What does that do to my heart? I don't know. It just tells me that those were very significant things that some people said to me that stuck 31 years later.
You find those things, do they motivate you?
Those things don't, I wouldn't say they necessarily motivate me. Some of them hurt me, you know, like, what did you do when you were pregnant? That hurt, you know, because you start thinking, what did I do? You know, I was active. And then I felt guilty because I didn't really want to be pregnant, you know, with her. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking, oh, golly, is this my punishment, you know? But, I mean, I knew that it wasn't. I knew that it was just, I actually, at that point, I didn't know what it was, but I knew that God wasn't punishing me for feeling that way, that that was just a normal reaction. And by the time I got big and pregnant, it was just hard to accept at first. I was like, I couldn't even talk to my mom about it for a while. I was like, I got to get my head wrapped around this new baby thing. But and like I said, if I'd known then what I know now, I couldn't have handled it. I mean, if I had known then that she would have a chromosomal deletion, I would have thought, oh, wow, how will I deal with this? But, you know, it was unveiled bit by bit, which helped. Although I will say for years, I walked around and felt like I had a cannonball lodged in my heart. You know, even having those aches down your shoulders and arms like you do with a heart attack. Mm-hmm. I said, I know exactly how a heart attack would feel because it was heartache. Because, you know, I was grieving my healthy baby because I found out she didn't really exist. Well, Kelly's very healthy. I will tell you that. She is because she puts everything in her mouth and her immune system is great. Never even got COVID.
Wow. I've got a couple more questions for
okay.
you. Okay. If that's okay.
That's okay.
So you've got grandkids. Mm-hmm. You're in retirement. Mm-hmm. What does joy look like for you and Steve?
Grandkids in retirement. You said it. Yeah, it really does. It seeing these amazing grandchildren, because they're so much better than I could have ever dreamed. Having them and seeing them grow up and seeing your children parent, that's the joy, is seeing your children parent and seeing what a good job they do. And how, I don't know, it's just, yeah, we drop everything. You know, we've got three of them live across the street from us. So that's awesome. And four of them are 12 minutes away. And then we have a new baby who's 7, 8 months old, almost 8 months old. So the joy is continuing.
Well, this has been a fantastic time. Thank you for sharing your story.
Well, like I said, it's Kelly's story mostly. And that's why I did this, is so I could talk about her.
I'll let those who listen determine if it's Kelly's story or not. So a final question. What piece of sage advice, what word of wisdom has been helpful to you, you think would be helpful to other people?
Well, I don't know. I think that don't ever discount what God can do in your life. Don't ever put limitations on Him. Don't ever assume that He can't take a horrible situation and make it awesome. I always cracked on. But, and that He can't truly turn lemons into lemonade if you'll let Him. But you have to submit. You have to surrender and say, you're in charge. I'm not.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks, Mindy.
Sure. Thank you.
The Lord bless you.
Thank you.
Well, a big thank you to Mindy for sharing her story. In listening to Mindy's story, I hope that you were inspired, encouraged, and challenged, and that you begin to behold the really cool people that are around you each and every day. As we wrap up today, we're wrapping up the first season of the Really Cool People podcast. A big thank you to all of you who've been listening. But as you listen today, I am away on sabbatical, and Taylor Likes, our editor and engineer, will be on sabbatical soon. When we return in the fall of 2023, We are looking forward to hosting more conversations and hearing the stories of really cool people. Between now and then, we will have a couple of bonus episodes, one in July and one in August. We've got more really cool people to get to know. The Really Cool People podcast is produced by Switzer Church, Springfield, Missouri. Taylor Likes is executive producer and editor, and I'm your host, Jason Leininger. You can help us by liking, reviewing, and sharing this podcast. Until next time.